The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello and joining you this week from London, where I've retreated for some final low altitude, low temperature, low pound against the Euro Giro d'Italia preparation, where I've recovered from the dire cold, which affected my performance in our Arrive podcast after Liège. Thanks for all the thousands of get well soon messages. Didn't get a single one. My name is Daniel Freiber, and I am the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we'll talk red and yellow cards exclusively in reference to cycling, not that other sport we have been known to mention. We'll turn armchair quarterback and Wednesday morning body language experts and psychoanalyze Patrick Lefebvre's handshake with Julien Alaphilippe at the end of Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And we'll hopefully zero in on the correct pronunciation of whatever bone Tadej Pogacar broke in his wrist after our guest today handed him a rather sinister-looking knitted voodoo doll on the start line at Liège. Let's meet that particular guest now so he can explain exactly what was going on. He is a Liège winner himself, a two-time monument winner, and also a former Quickstep rider. Alas, it's not Remco Evenepoel. Actually, no, alas. As far as we know, Remco hasn't penned an acclaimed autobiography. We doubt he's ever studied L'Étranger by Albert Camus, the most random thing I could find in the aforementioned autobiography. And he's never co-hosted this podcast, all things to which this man can lay claim. He is the rider formerly known as Crosswinds, Disco Dan, 2013 Liège winner, Dan Martin. And the man who presented Tadej Pogacar with that, what was it, a knitted panda on the start line on Sunday, which didn't bring your old mate much luck down. We know the story about you and pandas. You were chased by a panda, of course, when you won Liège. But what? Tell us about this doll you presented Pogacar with.
Well, I didn't present it to him. That photo was taken, and I will post it on social media. I haven't done it yet. That was supposed to bring him some luck. And I just thought 10 years since the panda...
He's now put a 10-year restraining order.
Exactly, yeah. So 10 years since the panda, and I thought the panda should make a reappearance at Liège and choose its winner. And unfortunately, it got it wrong. So perhaps it was the 2014 version of the panda that maybe fall off on the last corner that it was that one right there. But yeah, it was... anyway, nice to be here. That was a 45-second intro.
It was long. Dan, just very quickly, L'Étranger by Albert Camus, you studied at A-level, is that right?
Yes, I did, yeah. Yeah, and La Gloire de Mon Père, which I managed to somehow pass an exam on without actually reading.
And very apt for you, because that is set in Aubagne near Marseille, and you lived very close to there, didn't you, when you were at Vichy? Vichy-la-Pomme, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's funny how Albert Camus was from Aubagne, even, and La Gloire de Mon Père was set there. So it is really weird how I ended up living there.
Indeed. Our other guest, not really a guest, co-presenter, he's not going to get treated to a long and elaborate intro today, because he was treated to a visit by me to North London to meet him yesterday. Lionel Burney, how are you?
I'm very well, Daniel. What a treat. What a treat that was, eh? Meeting up in 3D yesterday in London for our kind of pre-Giro planning and editorial meeting, wasn't it?
It was looking in fine form, Lionel. Yeah. It's good to see you.
Yeah, you too. You ran to meet me, didn't you? Over your cold in under 24 hours. I was quite impressed by that, because you were rough on Sunday. Despite no one wishing you get well soon. I mean, I thought it. I didn't. Maybe didn't say it, but I did think it, I promise.
The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Well, a very big thank you to Super Sapiens, who've been our title sponsors for the past 2 years. They started in May 2021, supporting the Cycling Podcast. But this is the last regular episode as title sponsors. And Daniel, I'm sure you want to join me in saying a big thank you to everyone at Super Sapiens.
Indeed.
But especially two of the company's founders, Phil Sutherland and Fitz Allen Crowe, for their support. Phil, actually, actually ran the London Marathon on Sunday, finished in a very respectable 3:17. What do you think of that, Daniel? That's pretty good.
That's a very good performance,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. And, well, Sifan Hassan, the women's winner, was wearing a Super Sapiens a patch on her arm. It just made me sort of quite interested that in the marathon, runners can wear the Super Sapiens patch, but of course it is still not permitted in UCI racing, but that may change in the future. Anyway, we've been very proud to be sponsored by such an innovative company, and we hope that we've helped to demystify their technology and explain it to a wider audience over the past couple of years. Certainly, speaking personally, I'm very grateful to them, because when I wore the Super Sapiens system for the first time in the summer of 2020, it raised some amber flags for me. I mean, to be honest, amber flags that I probably recognized but ignored, in the sense that I was a bit too heavy and I needed to lose some weight. But seeing some data on my phone and seeing how my glucose spiked after certain types of food was really interesting and instructive, as was the way that I can actually bring those spikes under control by just subtly changing the types of food that I ate and the time that I ate them. I mean, Daniel, you'll testify that Hungry Liner was never a great travel companion, but I seem to have eradicated those extreme spikes and dips in my energy levels. And I've lost...
Mainly resolved that by eradicating travel. not the case anymore. Not the case anymore. You have been on the road the last few weeks.
I did have a bit of a break from travel. But it was the start of a weight loss journey in conjunction, actually, with one of our other regular advertisers, Noom, which, you know, in unsophisticated language is a weight loss app. But it was Super Sapiens that really kicked off that journey and made me a lot more aware of the impact that certain types of food were having on my blood glucose. And well, I am today still 14 kilos lighter than I was in September 2021. So a big thank you from me to Super Sapiens for that. Thank you to Super Sapiens from the Cycling Podcast. They will remain friends of the podcast for life. If you want to find out more about them, go to supersapiens.com and keep listening to the Super Sapiens podcast.
Lionel, Dan, time for the news roundup. Quite a skimpy, sparing news roundup this week. Not that much racing, actually, in the last few days. The Tour of the Alps finished on Friday with victory for a rider who's very familiar to podcast listeners. That is the 2020 Giro d'Italia champion, Teo Gegenhardt. This was Teo's first win in the GC of a stage race since that Giro. And it came after he won both of the first two stages. His final margin of victory was 22 seconds over Hugh Carthy, which sounds closer than the race actually was, if you watched it. And Jack Haig finished third, 28 seconds down. There's a bit of a private joke, a running gag between Teo and Jack Haig about who's the world's number one redhead. In preparation for the enormously important Arsenal game on Friday night, Teo and I had exchanged a few messages about this. He was very glad not only that he'd won Tour of the Alps, but to have beaten Jack Haig. Also, it was a handy week for Leonard Kemna. Bora, he won a stage. Gregor Mühlberger of Movistar and Simon Carr of EF Education First. Another good week for EF Education First. Georg Steinhauser was also pretty strong in that race, Tour of the Alps. On the stage race front, we've got the Tour de Romandie starting as we speak, as we're recording today. Juan Ayuso is on the start list there. He, of course, you'll remember, was third as a teenager in the Vuelta a España at the end of last year, but he has not yet raced so far in 2023 because of Achilles tendon issues. Other notable riders on the start list, the Yates brothers, obviously riding for different teams now. Mark Cavendish is also there. I had a call from Mark Cavendish last night. He's in good fettle, good mood ahead of the Giro d'Italia. I think most people know that he was due to ride the Giro. That's still the plan. Riding a lot, racing a lot. Dan, Lionel and I, before we started recording, we were just talking about this. Tour of Romandie, it's really fallen out of favour as a Giro d'Italia preparation race. The only people who do it to prepare for the Giro now are sort of domestique, second tier riders or sprinters.
It seems a bit much, to be honest. I think, especially when the Giro starts on a Friday, obviously this year it's starting on a Saturday, and Tour of Romandy, I think it also shows that how difficult racing is. There is no easy days racing there. And Tour of Romandy used to be a bit more of a cruisy race that you could go and kind of use it as a tune-up for the Giro d'Italia. Whereas now it's a very challenging race in itself. And obviously with that, you accumulate a lot of fatigue, and only having 5 days before you leave for the Giro, before you start the Giro, rather. It's only, you'd probably end up going straight from the finish in Geneva or wherever it finishes this year to the start line or at least have time to go home, pack your bag, and then leave on the Tuesday morning to go to the Giro. So there isn't really space for it now, as far as a prep race.
And in recent years, at least, the weather has often been stinking at the Tour de Romandie, which in some cases might be good preparation for the Giro, because we've had some Giri in the last few years where the weather hasn't been great either. But yeah, probably quite risky to start Romandie and do the Giro. Chaps, we mentioned Juan Ayuso. Speaking of much ballyhooed Spanish prodigies at the weekend, the 43-year-old gravel racing wunderkind Alejandro Valverde, and it's his birthday today, 43 today. I think it's also Brian Cocao's birthday. I think he's 31. Valverde made his debut in the discipline, gravel discipline that is, at the Indomable, literally the untamable. But tame it, Valverde did, thereby taking the lead and the rather fetching leader's jersey in the brand new UCI Gravel World Series. I think there were 17 races in that, chaps. Not sure how many he's going to ride. Valverde won by nearly 5 minutes, which sounds like a lot. But in the women's race, Caroline Schiff of Canyon CLLCTV won by nearly 15 minutes. Lionel, you are sitting in your home studio, and behind you, you've got the Tour de France, an iteration, some kind of version replica of a Tour de France combined jersey from the 80s. It was slightly, this gravel World Series jersey that I mentioned, which is quite attractive, is slightly reminiscent of that. I don't know if you saw it.
I haven't seen it, but now you've told me it looks like my favourite cycling jersey of all time, I have to look it up and see what it looks like. The jersey behind me is the combination classification jersey from 1989 and I think 1990, or maybe only 1989, I can't remember. I've made a kilometre zero about the Italian pop artist who did the rather wacky designs for the 1989 Tour de France leaders jerseys. And well, the combination classification jersey, well, it didn't last much longer after that, did it? I think they retired it in the early 90s when Jean-Marie Leblanc wanted to simplify the classifications and make it easier for people to understand what on earth was going on. I mean, there were so many leaders jerseys by the end of the 80s, weren't there?
There was a lot of talk at the weekend about the colour of Remco Evenepoel's shorts. He was wearing white shorts at Liège, Bastogne-Liège. Of course, Valverde wore brown shorts with a blue Movistar jersey in the Indomable, which was an unusual combination. I don't know if you saw that, you chaps. It got me thinking, Dan, actually, when you were Irish champion, did you ever rock the white shorts?
I did, actually. Yeah. I thought you had white shorts with green panels on some occasions. I think we had a number of different iterations, because when you design a national champion's jersey, it isn't just a free-for-all from the team. The federation actually has to okay it, and there's obviously certain guidelines. And I think we had about two or three incredible designs knocked back from Garmin, from the Garmin days, from the Slipstream team.
You had a nice one. I remember. We got one right. I remember, Dan, you having a nice one. I remember way back, first time I ever interviewed you, the Volta a Portugal in 2008, I believe. I think you were Irish champion then. I seem to remember that being a nice jersey.
Yeah, we did. Well, we played off the original Garmin jersey from the 2008 Tour de France, which was... it wasn't symmetrical, so it was kind of a nice design. It allowed us to get a little bit of freedom as far as putting I think there was a free. I have a photo of it somewhere. We'll have to post it. A bit of a heart back 15-year anniversary, 15 years ago that is. But we were actually talking about the whole leaders jersey situation in the Tour de France and the big races over the weekend, and with the way cycling has now gone, the young rider jersey seems to be almost irrelevant, because it just seems to be the leader's jersey at the moment. So perhaps it's time now. I think the more exceptional classification should be the over 30s almost. be a bigger battle. Oh,
this is a way back in for Valverde here, isn't it? Some kind of grey jersey for the over 30s. Maybe these brown shorts, Daniel, hint that Valverde's in some kind of tug of love battle between Movistar and AG2R, and he is going to come back at the Vuelta after all.
We have some kind of mammal jersey instead. So it's instead of showing the young riders, it's inspired the... Well, I mean, it depends how extreme you go. Grey jersey with brown shorts. Does that... I'm not a fashionista, but does that work?
I don't know. There seems to be a universal recognition that if you're riding any kind of gravel event, you have to be wearing brown, which I don't know. It seems a bit literal to me. Just talking about jerseys, Dan, you mentioning... been at Liège and talking about jerseys at Liège. Liège is an ASO race, of course. Don't know whether I spoke about this after Paris-Nice. I had a few conversations with people at Paris-Nice where the much darker hue of the green jersey got people talking. At Paris-Nice, Skoda are promoting their electric vehicles, and the sort of colour they're using, the signature colour, is quite a dark green, and that was the colour of the green jersey at Paris-Nice. A lot of people didn't like it, but that is going to be the colour of the green jersey at the Tour de France, I believe. Chaps, looking ahead now to the Giro d'Italia, we mentioned it a minute ago, we'll start to get some team news in the next few days, and Trek Segafredo have already got a selection headache as Giulio Ciccone tested positive for COVID-19, and his participation in La Corsa Rosa is now uncertain. Ciccone finished 13th in Liège at the weekend, and of course, were he to start in the Giro, which was very much the plan, he would be the enfant du pays, he'd be the local hero, because the Giro is starting in his home region, Abruzzo. Not many riders from Abruzzo. Another rider who is from Abruzzo, Dario Cataldo, he's also rides for Trek Segafredo, but of course he's recovering from a terrible accident he suffered a few weeks ago. So we're not sure whether Ciccone will start. Also on Trek Segafredo, I noticed just a couple of hours ago, actually, before we started recording, our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio, who you'll be hearing a lot from at the Giro d'Italia, he tweeted that Antonio Tiberi, who of course has been suspended by Trek Segafredo as a result of that very unsavoury incident involving him shooting a cat. He was suspended for 20 days on the 28th of February, but has not come back to racing, hasn't made any appearances since then. And Ciro has just tweeted that an imminent transfer, is likely, that Tiberi might be going from Trek Segafredo to Bahrain victorious. But that is unconfirmed. I think, chaps, that concludes the news roundup.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Well, the Giro d'Italia is approaching, Daniel, and that always reminds me of a very important anniversary for the Cycling Podcast, because this year marks 7 years since Science in Sport began sponsoring us, and we are incredibly grateful to that long-running relationship. And, well, it's a big week for Science in Sport because it's the Tour de Lunsa, which is a four-day stage race in and around Freetown in Sierra Leone. There's actually a women's race and a junior race on Wednesday, April the 26th, before the four-day stage race begins. That runs from Thursday to Sunday. And the Tour de Lunsa is sponsored by Science in Sport, and that's an initiative instigated by Stephen Moon, the CEO of Science in Sport. And it's thanks to Stephen that Science in Sport has been a long-running partner for the Cycling Podcast too. Now, we're going to be getting some material recorded on the ground in Sierra Leone for a forthcoming episode of Service Course. A really fascinating race, really interesting initiative, and we are keen to find out more about Science in Sport's involvement supporting the Tour de Lunsa. So listen out for that over the coming weeks. Of course, Science in Sport can fuel your ride, whether you're racing, training, got everything you need for before, during, and after your effort. So go to scienceinsport.com to check out the full range of energy products.
Well, I know you mentioned the anniversary of our union with Science in Sport. Talking of anniversaries, 10 years since Dan Martin was chased by a panda and won, not in Liège, in Anse, but it was Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Dan, you were there at the weekend. You were making a debut of sorts. We talked about Alejandro Valverde making his debut at the UCI World Gravel Series. You were making your debut in the commentary box. I mean, I know you've done it for ITV. You had little stints last year working for us. I can talk about us because I work for them as well. But you did the whole race at the weekend. But what was it like being in Liège, first of all, 10 years on?
It was a strange feeling because I think it made me realize that it was 10 years ago, which seemed, well, it seems like a long time, but it seems to have flown by. And it was touching about being able to catch up with all the peloton, a lot of guys I hadn't seen for quite a while, and between team staff, riders, and even the organization, that they got me up on stage. That was a bit of a surprise, to be honest, to talk about it being 10 years since I won and who was my favorite for the day. And then, yeah, great experience spending the day with Anthony McCrossan and Hannah Walker in the commentary booth. And I went into it completely underprepared because obviously not knowing what I needed to prepare was a little bit, but now I know. And a 4-hour stint in the commentary booth was definitely a new experience, but the time flew by. I mean, yeah, just all I had to do was watch bike racing, which, yeah, it was and using my knowledge of the course and being able to discuss with the riders beforehand what was going to happen and how they were feeling was also quite useful to hopefully give a bit of insight to the international viewers. I don't think it was accessible in the UK, but or in Europe even. But hopefully a few of the listeners managed to tune into my debut.
When you were on the podium, Dan, was the panda just behind your shoulder there, just out of sight? They didn't bring the panda back for the 10th anniversary.
The evil voodoo panda was stuffed in my pocket, actually. But the
yeah, I was going to say, I was about to ask you, when you weren't putting a curse on Tadej Pogacar, when you were doing your pit walk in the morning, because you were circulating, as you just mentioned, Dan, on the start grid, if we can call it that. What did you observe, Dan? What was the mood like? Did you pick up anything that, with hindsight, after Remco romped Liège, you later came to think, well, that was probably quite significant?
I actually picked up the opposite. I found Remco, although he was very, very confident, I think the remarkable thing about all of these young riders is how they deal with the pressure and the public being so, they're the center of attention. And they have, especially Remco racing in Belgium, he appeared to sign on to do the meet to the media zone 5, maybe even 10 minutes before the rest of his team. Specifically to do extra.
He loves it though, doesn't he, Dan?
Exactly.
Do you not think he really relishes it?
He seems to. And I find that amazing as a young rider, because you see so many young riders who crumple under the pressure after they've had a breakthrough season, whereas he seems to embrace this pressure, embrace his newfound celebrity status, especially in Belgium. But then he also showed up to the start line probably 7-8 minutes to go and stood front row soaking up the atmosphere. And I personally always found that in a race like the age, you spend as much time hidden away as possible because the race is long enough and the tranquility of the team bus is actually a safe haven. You're not using energy. Whereas he was up and about, he'd left the team bus effectively 30 minutes before the start, between doing 15 minutes of interviews and then he rushed back to his team bus for 5 minutes and then suddenly he appeared again. Whereas Tadej Pogacar, he showed up literally, he rolled to the start as the gun was going. He was so relaxed, so happy, so calm. It was quite interesting, the difference in the approach to the start to the race. And yeah, I think honestly it was just sheer bad luck by the sounds of it. I talked to a few of the guys after the race and it was just a freak accident effectively. So Mikel Honoré, he basically hit a hole and his tire exploded directly in front of Tadej Pogacar. And then, yeah, Tadej obviously had just nowhere to go. And I think Tadej was the only other rider to crash. So it was literally, and they were right in the top 10, 15 riders of the peloton. So it was really a completely, I mean, obviously in my book, I talk a lot about fate and it seems it was that day, you know, and of course, maybe it was the voodoo panda that struck him down again, like I did it for me in 2014.
Dan, I talked in our podcast, in our Arrive podcast, so directly after the race on Sunday, about how I'd sort of been conditioned, influenced by, I'd read a lot of stuff in the days leading up to the race about how well Remco had been training in Tenerife, and I found my sort of inner kind of weather vane shifting slightly from Pogacar towards Remco. I started to get the feeling that he was going to win, and I don't know if you felt strongly either way. I also mentioned on Sunday that L'Equipe had done a bit of a straw poll of pundits, experts, and it was overwhelmingly in favour of Pogacar, 14-1 in favour of Pogacar. What was your feeling
around the team paddock? It was quite equal, but the atmosphere at the Quickstep bus was actually remarkably calm. When you read everything in the press about the amount of pressure that Patrick Lefebvre is putting on his team, I expected to go there and see a nervous team, an anxious team, but they were very, very relaxed. It was just laughing, joking. They were confident, and it seemed like they had confidence. I think it seems that Remco actually instills that confidence across the whole team. They say, like, even just talking to random members of staff, like I talked to the bus driver once the race started. I went and had a coffee with him, and he said, it's just amazing how he controls the team. He basically takes the team meeting and will instruct the riders what each of their jobs is. So it's not the director doing that. It's Remco doing that, yeah. And telling them, okay, you're going to ride that power on that climb, and you're going to ride that power on that climb, and then you're going to do this. And he really, his presence at the race among that team just asserts this level of tranquility that, like, allows them to race how they did on Sunday. I think the whole team just stepped up a level and rode out of their skins, whereas the UAE bus is very much a less, like, a tranquil, low kind of very relaxed atmosphere. Like, Tadej, when I went to the bus, Tadej pokes his head out the window and starts shouting at me, that but a little bit less organized, but less, it was an interesting dynamic. Obviously, I think the attitude at UAE was a bit like, well, we've won a lot of races already, so we don't really, today, if we win, if we don't, we don't. Whereas it was a controlled confidence at the Quickstep bus. So, but I think very much, as you say, very much the atmosphere of the race, everybody was expecting Tadej to win, but except for Remco. Remco knew he was going to win. He knew he was going to put on a big performance that day.
It's funny you say that about Remco's leadership, Dan. I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago in relation to the documentary that Quickstep have just put out about last year, it shows a lot of what went on behind the scenes at the Vuelta a España last year. And I said the same thing. It was mainly Remco taking the team meetings. And, you know, it's interesting. This is a guy who, until not that long ago, probably just before the Vuelta last year, had this reputation as being slightly immature, brattish, some people might have even said. Yet when you watched him in that setting, you get the completely opposite impression. And actually, my interactions with him at the Vuelta last year in the mix zone, he was incredibly comfortable in his own skin, incredibly confident, and he's charismatic as well. And as we said, he also relishes the limelight, relishes the pressure. I think he relishes the pressure because he knows how good he is. He's so confident. He knows he doesn't really have anything to be afraid of when he goes into races like Liège at the weekend. That's my sense anyway.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. But it also, a lot can, as like Tadej crashing shows, a lot can happen in a bike race. And it's, but they seem to be able to control the controllables very, very well. And he's, there was no doubt how he was behaving in the paddock. Yeah, as you say, he's a rider in control, and he's mature. And how he spoke in the after race interview as well on the podium, very, very mature. Especially, you forget how young he is, and inexperienced as well. We can't forget that. How long has he been professional now? 3 years? It's 4 years even. It's and this is all very new to him, really. But it doesn't seem like it.
You catch up with your old boss at the weekend, Dan, Patrick Lefebvre. I said we were going to psychoanalyze his interactions with, or his handshake with Julien Alaphilippe when Alaphilippe came over the line, and they sort of celebrated. Alaphilippe was hugged by Remco's mum, and then it was I wouldn't say frosty, but a perfunctory handshake between Patrick Lefebvre and Julien Alaphilippe, I would say. Can you dish any dirt on that for us, Dan, please?
Patrick was the only guy that I didn't cross paths with. And it's probably a good thing, as I was tempted to ask him where he was going for lunch on Sunday. But Yeah, it was. No, the rest of the team were saying, yeah, that obviously there's a bit of stress floating around there. And I think, yeah, Patrick obviously has his agenda set in his mind. And potentially, I guess, Julian doesn't fit in that plan now, even though he still has a contract for another year. So whether he's playing games or not, well, only Patrick knows. But remains to be seen how things move forward in that relationship and how Julian copes with that. I spoke to Julian and he was very, very relaxed, very happy to be there. I think it was nice for him not to have the pressure of the team with Remco there. But he also, I think he did a great performance considering his build up to the race. But yeah, whether he wants to go and be the number one in a different team, I think that's essentially what Patrick's saying to him. It's almost like, I think Patrick's almost giving him the green light to leave the team now, to go and pursue his own endeavours. And perhaps that was also a sign on Sunday. It was that was Patrick saying, look, either you leave or you ride for Remco, kind of thing, you know? Who knows? But I didn't see this handshake. I didn't see... I saw Julian cross the line, but it's... Yeah, it's a bit of a soap opera waiting to roll out.
I mean, Lefebvre is the only team boss who would expect both of his highest paid riders to win the same race and be disappointed that they couldn't both win. You know, he does strike us as a demanding character, and he has kind of put the squeeze on Alaphilippe over the past few weeks, hasn't he?
For sure. And it's kind of been accumulating over the last few years. Julian hasn't had the best 18 months now. But I do think that there is a certain way to put pressure on a rider, and how Patrick's doing it is not correct. You need to give, when a rider's having a bad time, especially somebody like Julian, who is used to winning, he's used to getting results, you need to give him a shoulder to cry, some support, just to be able to say, look, we know you're still a good rider, just relax and the results will come, not you need to go and win. Like that's really, it's because there's one person that understands he needs to go and win more than anybody, and that's Julian Alaphilippe. So, yeah, I mean, obviously he's going to step back now, I think, and rebuild towards the Tour de France. We don't really know what the makeup of this team will be at the Tour de France, probably around a sprinter, probably Fabio Jakobsen, I guess. So it will be interesting to see if Julian makes that team even, because at the moment that kind of looks unlikely, and it would be a big, big step, a big statement if he didn't make the Tour de France team for that Soudal Quickstep team.
I mean, there are some rumours going around that he may not even be at Quickstep this summer, that Lefebvre might have been trying to unhinge himself from Alaphilippe even before the Tour de France. I don't think there's too much substance to that. But, you know, when it comes to the contract and how much it's worth, but also mainly the duration of it. I mean, it was Lefebvre who, he put his... signature to a 3-year contract in 2021 as well. You know, he's been around long enough to know the perils of signing long contracts with, let's face it, riders who are probably, I'm not going to say over the hill, but they're on the plateau, the age plateau. And so I don't think I've got too much sympathy with that. But just on the tactics of the way that Quickstep rode, Dan, I mean, they were obviously under a lot of pressure. We talked on Sunday about how there was a point where they looked as though they might become exposed. I pinpointed when Mollema attacked, I think it was 46 or 7 kilometers ago, so shortly before La Redoute, and they only had two guys left, Vavecka and Van Wilder, and it looked like that was the point at which the vessel could start taking on water at that point, and possibly that could have capsized them. But they regrouped and Vavecka came back to the front. I don't know whether, you know, other teams might have tried something to compound whatever damage was being done, had been done at that point, and then whether that was a point where they might have been vulnerable. But Remco was so strong. I mean, is there anything anyone could have done?
That was definitely a turning point. I mean, the other teams allowed Vavecka to come back into the race. He was I think they actually lost 30 seconds to the breakaway during that point, because the peloton slowed down so much. And that's what allowed Vavecka to come back and be able to pace them into the bottom of La Redoute and keep Remco in good position. So, yeah, Remco was clearly the strongest guy in the race. But I think what was slightly disappointing was the fact that when Mollema attacked, Ineos still had five riders left, including Tom Pitcock, but they could have tried to break up the race somehow, because the race stopped, it slowed down, it was a flat section, it would be very difficult to control something there. And at least some riders, it's easier said than done, of course, but if there was a few riders who almost knew they were going to get dropped in Laredoux anyway, get a head start. Even if you start Laredoux with 20 seconds, it gives you the opportunity to maybe be with Remco at the top of the climb. Because the whole race knew almost the day before when Remco went and did a test run of Laredoux at full speed, getting the Strava record. Everybody knew who's going to attack on Laredoux. So it was a case of, it was almost like the race has got a psychological block now as far as racing for second place, which is totally understandable. But at the same time, with those teams that had a few riders there, could have tried something before the descent down to it's Robuchon, isn't it, the bottom of Laredoux.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
Well, chaps, before we move on, just a few bits of housekeeping here, because the Giro d'Italia is fast approaching and we will be back with daily coverage once again.
Our trailer dropped today, Lionel.
That's right. Yes, our now traditional video trailer of last year's highlights from behind the mic, expertly put together once again by you, Daniel, really whetting the appetite for the Giro d'Italia. You'll be there from the start. Daily episodes of the Cycling Podcast, of course, and Kilometre Zero will be back. Three episodes of Kilometre Zero a week. Now, that will most likely be available for friends of the podcast. So if you would like to sign up as a friend of the podcast, go to thecyclingpodcast.com and click on where it says sign up as a friend of the podcast. And you can then browse through the now extensive archive of our special episodes as well. We've got lots of other things coming over the next few months as we build up through the Giro and then the Tour de France. But yes, it's likely that Kilometre Zero will be available to friends of the podcast subscribers throughout the Giro.
We'll probably throw a few crumbs, a few episodes, the enemies of the podcast. They'll probably get a couple.
I mean, I'll be impressed. Have the enemies of the podcast.
How do I become an enemy of the podcast?
Quite easily.
We don't have any enemies.
Daniel. Very easily. quick mention for our clothing partners at MAP. You may remember a few weeks ago we were talking about their Pursuit of Progression campaign. They were asking people to set their goals for 2023, and listener Jamie Roberts sent us a really entertaining email about his ride from the UK all the way to Barcelona, because he was off to see the boss, Bruce Springsteen. His daughter had got tickets. Jamie first saw the boss, Bruce Springsteen, in Montpellier in 1985, and his daughter got him tickets for the opening night of the European Tour, which is in the Olympic Stadium in Barcelona, which is only now a couple of days away. And we saw on Twitter that Jamie has covered 941 kilometres of his ride. He's got 361 to go as of yesterday. He's been on the road 10 days. He's got to get over the Pyrenees, though, and into Spain and then down to Barcelona.
But these are the glory days.
He's going to make it for the opening song, I am sure. Good luck, Jamie. Hope you have a great time on, I think it's Friday night there.
Everyone at some point has to see the boss in concert, don't they? Have you, Lionel?
I have.
I saw him at Wembley once. Yeah. Just once. I'd like to see him again.
I saw him at Glastonbury once.
Dan?
No, I haven't seen him, no.
Definitely a rite of passage.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely tremendous. I mean, he played songs that were unfamiliar to me for about an hour, and then launched into the favourites. But anyway, a couple of other things to mention: the 11:01 cappuccino. Sign up for that, because that's where you'll find out all about our Giro coverage. If you haven't listened to Arrivé from either the men's or women's races, do so. Liège-Bastogne-Liège, we covered, of course, on on Sunday. Daniel and I took on the men's race, and Lizzie Banks and Rose Manley talked about the demolition of the women's race by Demi Vollering. There's also an episode of the Cycling Podcast Feminine coming very soon in the next few days with Lizzie, Rose and Orla. And just very quickly before we get back to the main meat of the podcast, Daniel, you asked the listeners to suggest improvements for Flesh Wallonne. Do you remember last week? And we had lots of comments, most people suggesting moving the finishing line either beyond the Mur de Huy or, you know...
I just know that Dan is grim. I can't see Dan currently, but I just know that he's grimacing.
He will be
Dan
grimacing.
Dan thinks that Flesh Wallonne is just fine.
Absolutely.
I just don't think... Yeah, it's like let's pave over some cobblestones as well to stop Paris-Roubaix being what it is. You know, it's an interesting one because I think Flesh Wallonne has this character of a race that's, yes, okay, it's different to every other race, but does every race really need to be super exciting? I think what does need to change is how cycling is portrayed, because it's one of the most nervous, stressful races of the year, Flesh Wallonne, but it just doesn't come across on camera. That's the big issue.
I think, yeah, absolutely right. I'm with you there, Dan. Lots of people suggested moving the finish line beyond the Mur de Huy. A couple of people actually suggested perhaps finishing it halfway up one year, maybe after the Z bend. I don't know. But the comment that really resonated with me, and it's probably a comment I should have made in our episode, Daniel, is from Claire Morley. And she points out that whereas it maybe doesn't come across on TV as a spectacle, to actually be there on the roadside, you know, it's pretty much one of the best days of the cycling calendar, because not only do you get to see both the men's and women's races, but they come past multiple times, and it's a natural stadium, isn't it? And she said, you know, you get the commentary from the loudspeakers, there's the big screen to watch the race on, great food and drink, very friendly crowd, and a real atmosphere building over the course of the afternoon. So absolutely, I mean, seeing any live sport is fantastic, but I can definitely say from my experiences of going to Flesh Wallonne, it never disappoints if you go and watch it in the flesh. So even if you even if you think, well, it's not a great afternoon's TV, I can guarantee you'll have a great time if you did venture over to the Ardennes and watch it.
Well,
wow.
Well, chaps, we finished the last part talking about Remco Evenepoel. Of course, Remco has a very important rendezvous coming up in just over a week's time. He is starting the Giro d'Italia, and he will be starting his favourite now. I've had a look at the odds, and he's pretty much the overwhelming favourite now, well ahead of Primoz Roglic. Liège-Bastogne-Liège was billed as a head-to-head battle between Remco, Clash of the Titans between Remco and Pog. We didn't get that. So now, instead of Pog, we've got Rog. Dan, I talked about the sort of internal weather vane and mine having pointed more towards Remco before Liège. How are you feeling about the Giro and the likelihood of Remco doing what he did at the Vuelta last year, albeit with the caveat that Rog was, he was coming back. It was a bit of a Rog remontada, wasn't it, before he crashed in the final week in Seville and crashed out of the race. So it's the rematch. What are you thinking?
I'm not sure I want to comment anymore, because every time I say anything, Remco seems to prove all of us wrong.
I thought you'd become an enemy of the cycling podcast second. I thought you'd sign up to our enemy's feed.
He just seems to tear up the textbook every race he does. And like Liège last year, a very good example of, yeah, when was the last time the race was won from an attack on Larry Doot? And he did the same again this year. So it's... yeah, I think the one thing with the Giro that seems to decide the race often is the weather. And whether it's good or bad, obviously, if it's snowy and wet, that can mean that the mountains are taking out. And that puts more emphasis onto the TTs, for sure, which I think will be an advantage for Remco. But as well, I think the Giro is the one race that riders first realize when you've got serious allergy problems. And Remco not having done the race before, if it's a hot Giro, you can discover that suddenly you can't breathe in Italy in May as well. So the weather can change the Giro a lot as far as who races where in the cold. We saw Remco last year; he suffered very badly on the snowy day was it the Dolomites or the Italian Alps? It was 2 years ago actually when Remco did it, wasn't it? And he lost. He was up there on GC and had a really bad day when it was cold and snowy. So he's a very different Remco now, obviously. But it's I think we're just very fortunate. We've got two of the so-called aliens of the peloton currently riding the Giro. It allows us to see this face off.
I mean, Dan, you talked there about allergies. If I can use a metaphor, we specialize in terrible metaphors or analogies, images in the cycling podcast. And, you know, the Giro, I talked a few weeks ago about it, but just being a bit more complicated. It's like a cake or a dish with more ingredients than the Vuelta, say. And with more ingredients, you're more likely to have some kind of food in or dietary intolerance. And, you know, they are allergies themselves, literal allergies. Roads aren't quite as good. There's more road furniture than there is at the Vuelta. I just think that it's a slightly more volatile mix.
It'd be interesting to see the attrition rate at the Giro versus the Tour and the Vuelta, because you seem to see a lot more of the top 10 fall apart in the last week of the Giro than you do in the Vuelta and the Tour. And I think it is, as you say, allergies, bad weather, crashes, the technical roads, illness. It seems to be a lot more susceptible in May than it is in the other Grand Tours. And it's a good point. There's a lot more ingredients of having a successful Giro than there is the other Grand Tours. But yeah, I think we're also in danger. It's kind of like Liège a bit as well. Although it did come down to Remco winning, there is a lot of other contenders. And because of those, because of the fact that so much can go wrong in the Giro, I think we can't forget a lot of the other riders involved, especially with strong Ineos team seemingly building momentum. But with Remco as well, obviously, I think we always point out that his team is potentially the weak point. And in one-day races, you don't really need to have the strongest team, although he proved that the team was very strong on Sunday. Over the course of a Grand Tour, it becomes very important, because if you're, especially in a race like the Giro, when you've got big climbs early on in the stage, there's a lot can go wrong earlier on in the stage, mechanicals, even if you're not feeling great. Like, obviously, we saw Chavez lose the whole race a few years ago, I think, from the first climb of the day, so in a 200-kilometer stage. So it's, that strength across the Quickster team is where I think the Jumbo-Visma team with Roglic seems to be their strongest point at the moment.
Dan, I was just going to ask you before we move on to talk about Pogacar, just these last couple of weeks before the Giro in particular, there's been a bit of talk in Belgium over the last few hours and last couple of days. Jan Bakkelands, guy you rode against for many years, one of your peers, he's now a pundit in Belgium, and he was sort of expressing some bafflement at Remco going back to altitude after Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And then, of course, you've got Roglic, who, and Lionel and I talked about this at the weekend, Jumbo-Visma, they decided that they weren't going to send Vingegaard, they weren't going to send Roglic, they weren't going to send Van Aert to the Ardennes. But Roglic, you know, he was given a pass there, so he's been at altitude the whole time in Tenerife. Remco came to Liège, and then he's going back to altitude. Now, I know you skipped Liège, I think, in 2021 when you were really focusing on the Giro. But what's your feeling about how you negotiate these last 2 weeks? What's the best recipe? And is it depends on the individual?
I think, definitely depends on the individual. And that was the big question mark about Remco coming directly from Tenerife to Liège. Normally, riders need a while to adapt to sea level and being able to do those explosive efforts after coming down from altitude, whereas he seems to have found a way of being able to cope with that. So also the effects of altitude, I mean, I'm not a scientist, but it's supposedly only lasts probably 2 to 4 weeks. So it makes sense that he'd be going back to altitude and coming down, back down to the, if he can cope with racing directly off the back of coming down, it makes perfect sense that he'd go back up. And especially now with the status that he has in Belgium or wherever, I think going to altitude and just being locked in a hotel, quiet, resting, it's definitely the best way for him to prepare for a Grand Tour, because he can definitely switch off as long as he's not thinking too much about the race. But obviously that doesn't seem to be a problem for for our world champion. So it's, they seem to have figured out what works best for him. So it does definitely make sense in my head what he's doing.
Should we move on to Pog? Should we have some wrist chat? I didn't mean to be facetious talking about you putting a curse on Pog, because of course, well, it was a big shame for the spectacle for us all who were looking forward to that clash of the Titans that I mentioned when he did crash on Sunday. But it's also very unfortunate for him and his team that he has crashed and he's got this injury. Had an operation immediately on Sunday on his wrist. I got the pronunciation of the bone that he'd broken wrong. I said it was a scaphoid. It's scaphoid, you pronounce it. Thanks to Marcus Banks, who's a long time listener, got in touch about that. He's an orthopedic surgeon, Marcus, isn't he? Hip specialist, I think. Anyway, there's been, I mentioned there all the talk about Remco, how he's preparing for the Giro. Obviously a lot of speculation now about Pog and the Tour. People computing how many days there are until the start of the Tour. I think 68 at last count. I've seen pundits saying that they're worried now for Pog. Laurent Jalabert gave an interview to a French website, said he thought that it'll be difficult now. There are others that say it's going to be no problem. Pogacar's posting all sorts on social media, pictures looking very chipper, looking as though he doesn't have a care in the world. Dan, you've got experience with wrist injuries, different wrist injuries, a different wrist injury. You had a crash in 2009, Volta a Catalunya, which you wrote in your book affected you for several years thereafter. Before I go to you then, Dan, I'll ask Lionel first. Lionel, have you had any thoughts about this over the last couple of days? If you had to bet now, I think Pog will be fine. I think he'll be fine.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to be able to get back on the whatever training, you know, indoor training, certainly very soon. But I would imagine that after the block of racing he's done, there's a little bit of downtime. There's some space for that before. What do we think he's going to do? Is he going to go to altitude before the Tour? Figure he will.
That was the plan, wasn't it? Because he hasn't done it yet. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, we're dealing with a sport where Matt Heyman fractured his collarbone, didn't he? Sort of 6 weeks, 5 weeks before Paris-Roubaix, and still won it. I mean, he will have, you know, he's already had his operation. They will be able to rejig his preparation and training plan. It's not like he's missing any racing. I think probably he'll be absolutely fine, but it does insert a little bit of jeopardy into the Pogacar-Vingegaard battle for the Tour de France and raise a bit of a question mark about Pogacar, and who knows? I mean, maybe your weather vane, Daniel, is probably pointing towards Denmark at the moment pretty firmly.
Dan, talk to us about that wrist injury. Yeah.
I think first of all, my wrist injury was mainly because I didn't actually break anything. I just got a tendon, almost like a sprained tendonitis type thing. And I started riding straight away almost, and just sitting, protecting the wrist, sitting slightly different on the bike meant that I created a weakness and an issue in my shoulder, which was really difficult to budge. And I still actually have issues now just from an imbalance in my muscular strength across my back. And it just shows that I think as far as his rehab is concerned, that's absolute priority, because if you come back too quickly, you can end up creating further damage than just a broken bone down the line. But I actually talked to him yesterday, and he was in really good spirits. So he was actually supposed to go on holiday this week anyway and head away and take probably, I don't know exactly how much time, but it's already a week, 10 days off the bike. And so, that's obviously, it's the first time he's ever had anything in his career like this, though. So it'd be interesting to see how he comes back mentally from that. I mean, he seems in really good spirits, but I actually was joking with him saying that he's a real cyclist, a real pro cyclist now, because he's actually fallen off, because I don't think he's, other than that little tip off at on the descent of the, was it the Col de Soulor or the before Hoogeveen last year? I don't ever remember him actually crashing his bike. So it's, I think he'll be just fine. Obviously, the one thing is now that if he has one bad day at the Tour, everybody's going to point the finger at this crash. And that's slightly unfortunate, because it is creating jeopardy as far as his move towards the Tour de France now. But at the same time, I think he probably got to the Tour last year a little bit. He was absolutely 110% conditioned, if that's possible. He was flying already in Slovenia. and maybe faded off towards the end of the race. We saw at Hoteleur coming home problems, and the last time trial he wasn't on the same level as Vingegaard. So this could actually mean he arrives at the race in better condition because he doesn't get overexcited and peak too early. It's going to definitely slow down his preparation and mean that he's not chasing his tail, but building into the race rather than arriving at the race in top condition. And as the race gets, it's such a difficult course this year, and it's so hard to hold top condition over the whole 3 weeks that could, when the decisive stages come, he'll probably end up using the race naturally now because he's had this setback. He'll end up building through the race and getting stronger as the race goes on.
He's certainly a rider who, in the past, when he's been fresh, has performed incredibly well, and fresh in terms of not having raced. I mean, his record in his first races of the season is pretty remarkable. Even going back to his Neopro season, he won the Algarve, didn't he? Tour of the Algarve. I think that was his first race, his first stage race. So yeah, that may well be the case, Tan. Before we leave the Liège chat, it would be remiss of us not to ask you about Ben Healy, Dan, because when we've been talking about him over the last two or three weeks, I've pointed out there's a slight similarity in your accents, I must say. There's a similarity in the one, well, you represent the same country, represented the same country. Not dissimilar riders as well. Do you know Ben Healy, Dan?
I was actually going to add as well, we haven't even mentioned Tom Pidcock, who's obviously got an amazing second on Sunday. But yeah, Ben, I mean, breakthrough week for him. He'd obviously build towards next year now, and obviously got a whole new level of respect across the peloton. And we definitely saw that on Sunday when he was a March rider. And yeah, I first met Ben in 2019 when actually my father was the under 23 director for, or junior director throughout the season. I think he was still junior there, Ben, even at the Harrogate World Championships. And he did a great ride there, just showed real character. And yeah, I started telling people then about him, saying, yeah, this kid's going to be good because he's just got grit. And I think that's important to acknowledge across the Ardennes Classics. It isn't just about putting down numbers. In the mountain stages of the Tour de France, it's all about a power-to-weight ratio and all that. But the Ardennes is about having that. You've got to have character. You've got to be able to fight for position. You have to be, everybody's tired at the end of these races, but you have to believe and just keep fighting all the way to the line. And that's exactly what he did. He just kept coming back for more, especially obviously Amstel. He had a bad day at Flesch after digging so deep at Amstel, but then obviously he came back for more in the age. And yeah, I think he's obviously got a bright future, and he seems to be in the right team as well. I mean, similar to myself, that team's got a great history in finding talents and really progressing them, helping them, giving them the right environment to build and improve. And he seems to be taking advantage of that situation and that freedom as well, being able to race openly tactically.
Well, chaps, we're talking on, as we've already mentioned, the first day of the Tour de Romandie. We're also talking on the day when Joe Biden has announced that he's going to run for the US presidency again. Well, the cyclists of the World Tour Peloton, not only the World Tour Peloton, all professional cyclists, they have a new president, don't they, Lionel, of sorts?
They do.
New president of the CPA.
They do. He's been in the cycling equivalent of the White House, whatever that would be, for just over a month. It's Adam Hansen.
Does this make Gianni Bugno Donald Trump?
I wouldn't like to comment. Gianni Bugno, the outgoing president. Adam Hansen ran for president more or less unopposed in the end. The people who had their eye on the presidency kind of stepped aside. And yeah, Adam Hansen, former World Tour pro, of course, long career with the likes of High Road and Lotto Soudal, very respected domestique, had that incredible streak of consecutive Grand Tours, didn't he? So, you know, been around the peloton a long time. And well, I spoke to him last week, and we'll put the full conversation out for friends of the podcast, because it was really interesting. First of all, getting a bit of insight into what the CPA actually is. It's basically a union, a rider union. It represents all of the professional riders, but I dug into the detail of exactly what it does. And well, people who follow Adam Hansen on social media, Twitter particularly, will see that he's been very active already, proactive, He's been to several races, Milan-San Remo, just a couple of days after he was elected as president. He's been on and off team buses at both men's and women's races, just introducing himself. And most of the riders will obviously know him, but I think he wanted to just demonstrate that he could hop onto the bus, say a few things quite succinctly, and then hop off the bus again and leave the impression that he is someone that is approachable with any gripes and grumbles from the peloton. He is, as I say, he's hit the ground running in the sense that he has already canvassed the riders for the things that they think are most important in their workplace. But the full interview is quite far reaching. But here is a little taste of Adam Hansen, the new CPA president. So, Adam, you have been the president, I think now, well, you're in the US, so you're a bit behind me. So I think for a month and a day, you were elected on the eve of Milan-San Remo, the first ever electronic vote, which I think was one of the contentious things last time round, wasn't it? The sense that that it was all being done on, I guess, postal ballots. But that was one of the things that led to this splinter organisation, the Riders' Union, being founded in the first place in 2020. So, I mean, I don't want to presume, but what's your kind of first priority? Is it to kind of show the riders that the CPA is there to represent all of the interests of the riders and bring back together some kind of unified and collective idea of what it is to be a professional cyclist?
Yeah, 100%. The CPA always represents everyone. And to give an example of that, like when we work on the joint agreement, that is for every rider. That is really for every rider. With the weather protocol, if the riders don't like us or not, that's for every rider. It's for even for the women's. It's, before they became members of the CPA, it's really for every rider. So you're right. My first goal is to show them working, show the CPA's working, show we're listening to the riders, gain the trust, the ones that have lost faith in us, and collectively together we'll be a stronger force. So yeah, it's to fix those things.
It does feel like you've hit the ground running. There's been a bit of momentum in this first month. I've been at a couple of races and I've seen you diving in and out of team buses, trying to talk to the riders, even just for a few minutes, but to just show your face. You were at Paris-Roubaix, you were at Milan-San Remo, I think, before that. Is that right? Yeah. So as your first priority just being to get in front of the riders, remind those of them that already know you, this is me, I'm now the president of the CPA, but also just to give a human face to this organization.
Yeah, so I actually went to also UAE tour beforehand just to, I wanted to speak to the riders first and listen to what they wanted. And I was speaking to some riders, I think we went from almost 3.5 hours. It was actually a long talk. And then how I actually presented myself was like, I went to the team hotel and having dinner. And I said, hey, there's a meeting afterwards. Come. There's no topic. I just want you to come and attack me with all your questions. And I know there's some hatred towards the CPA and go for it. Oh, I'm here to answer everything, explain everything. And it was good, actually. I had some guys answer. And I had some tough questions, but I was able to answer them. And they were surprised with the answers because, you know, there's I don't want to call names out to anyone, but there's some people that have said some, let's say, not true information about the CPA. But that's okay. I just got to prove them wrong in the long run. And but that started up. And then, Milan-San Remo was at Pay Basque also, the women's Paris-Roubaix, the men's Paris-Roubaix. And it was. There's a few things I wanted to do. First, show my face, show that CPA is around. Two, show them what I'm working on based on what I heard from the UAE tour of the riders, because I asked the main topics. And three, I wanted to show the teams I can go into a bus, speak for a minute and hop out, because I want them to know in the future, Adam's here, it's okay. He's only 1 minute on the bus. It's not like, before a race, you know, he comes in, he talks 10 minutes. Like, I really wanted to get in there, get out as fast as possible. Say my line, here's my contact information. Guys, contact me on this, WhatsApp, whatever, I'll do it. And just to show that, you know, I'm here to, you know, and to say to them, like really say to them, I work for you. I really work for you. And I can only do what you tell me. So if you don't tell me anything, I'm going to work on these topics, and that's what I'm going to do.
Well, one of the things that Adam Hansen's been doing is posting some of the results of his rider survey on Twitter. One of the most eye-catching is the idea of having yellow and red cards for riders who ride dangerously or cause incidents in the peloton. That created quite a lot of debate. But I think what he is trying to do is demonstrate to the riders that it's their union, it's their sport, and that if they want to have a voice, they need to speak up and have a voice. Dan, I don't know what you thought during your long career of the role of the CPA, whether you ever made representations to the CPA, spoke to anyone involved, what you thought of the rider union as a whole.
Yeah, I think it's a great move what Adam's doing, because it's obviously he's relatable. He's the guys know him already, or many of them do, and he actually speaks English, which is the way the peloton is going. I mean, Gianni, I don't think I ever met him in 14 years in the peloton, and rarely had came into contact with anybody from the CPA. You either had to go looking for them or contact them by email or whatever. And it was actually an effort where he's coming across as very approachable, and he's actually in touch with the current peloton. I mean, that's Gianni Bugno retired 10 years before I even turned pro. And I know how much the peloton changed during just my career. So how much it must have changed.
20 years, Dan. 15, Gianni Bugno.
No, 1998. I actually retired checked and I turned pro in 2008. So 25 years.
Yes.
Yeah, 25 years from now, he retired. And yeah, that's a huge amount of time. And obviously, it's the majority of the, I mean, even teams like La France de Jour now, there's English within the team. And the fact that we've now got the English-speaking president that the majority can actually communicate with, and he's open to communication, he's open to the new ideas from the peloton, and it's a massive step forward. But I will say, obviously, he's got a very difficult job, because there are so many different opinions within the peloton. If you ask the same question to all the guys, you're always going to come back with 50 different answers. So it's a very difficult job trying to balance all the different requests and opinions across the what's a hugely diverse and international sport now. But he's making a great start, but he's also obviously very fresh and motivated at the moment. So it's gonna be interesting to see how much. It's one thing putting Twitter polls out there, it's another thing getting those ideas passed as official rules.
I mean, logically, of course, Dan, I agree with you, but there are those of us who sort of facetiously would inwardly decry the rampant anglicization of English. I yearn for the days, not that long ago, when there was an occasion about 10 years ago where there was a pre-direct sportive briefing before a French race, the GP Cholet, I think, in the Loire in France, and Marc Madiot stormed out because they started to conduct the meeting in English, and he said, "This is a French race, this has to be conducted in French." Anyway, it's just the way of the world, isn't it? As I say, rampant anglicisation.
Well, he's obviously signing more English riders now, or Australians at least, and obviously Jake Stewart as well, he's there as well, so it's he's seen the way of the world.
Yeah, one of the things that Adam Hansen was talking about was that it is the riders' union, and he will take to the various different stakeholders the views of the riders. And of course, there's the race organisers, the teams. The riders often find themselves caught in the middle of all of the various sort of power grabs in professional cycling. But he did also say that the most pressing matter for the riders that he has polled so far is the issue of safety, and he's coming up with some fairly radical proposals, some ideas that just to put them on the table for discussion. One of them being indicating to riders much sooner before a traffic island. We often see, don't we, the steward with the flag will be right in front of the traffic island. You know, he's been polling the riders, would it be better to have that, I don't know, 50 metres, 25 metres, whatever, in front of the obstacle so that riders have more reaction time. You know, the movement of motorbikes, the movement of cars around the peloton as well is something that he's been asking the riders for, because of course it's the riders who know intimately how they and everything else connected to the race moves. And one of the things that he's asked about, should there be, you know, more obvious and understandable sanctions for riders who cause incidents or ride dangerously? This yellow and red card system, anyone who doesn't like football will be absolutely horrified at the footballification of professional cycling.
Anglicization and footballification. What's worse? I know which I which I would say
I think
is
it's
worse.
A tricky one as well, isn't it? Because one, I think you're seeing a lot less respect among the riders now. You just see a lot less times when riders are pointing obstacles out and looking after each other. And that's, yes, okay, the roads are becoming more cluttered with street furniture. And at some points, you never have your hands on the handlebars. You're pointing at, if you have to point out every single obstacle. But at the same time, that's also extra cost for the organization of races that's already struggling. So perhaps it's more to do with the UCI selecting, avoiding towns and cities, which, yeah, obviously it's inevitable at some point. But so often when you do these races and you take it straight through the center of a city with roundabout traffic islands all over the place, is there not a better way through these towns and picking roads that are less cluttered? And then obviously the red card, yellow system. Yeah, it's all great in theory. I think they're all great ideas, but it's the implementation of these things that's going to be the challenge. Because that involves having a race jury who has to watch all the images. And is it during the race this happens? Is it after? I think, as you say, you find yourself playing devil's advocate here a little bit, because they're quite obvious ideas. And you'd think that it'd be spotted beforehand that these things would have been put into place. But it's going to be interesting to see the interest of the UCI to actually start doing some of these, because at the same time now, there's a list of UCI rules for requirements of stage finishes, etc., that are very rarely adhered to. So and they don't enforce their own rules on those finishes and stuff. They kind of send a list to the race organizer and say, here, this is what you're supposed to do. But nobody's actually checking that they do it. So how do you enforce these rules as well?
Do you feel in your time as a rider, Dan, that the riders were kind of voiceless in a lot of situations? You know, the idea that the riders just sort of strap on a helmet and climb on the bike and the conditions are the conditions, and really they don't really have a great deal of representation when it comes to the types of races and the types of working conditions that are expected of them.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's you see the... Obviously, finally, there was the weather protocol passed, but how long does it take for these rules to actually be brought into reality? And there's also, it's the issue of safety has been, I think riders now have a much greater voice because of social media, because it's easier to get your voice across. Whereas beforehand, obviously the same arguments have been said for decades, but they weren't as easily accessible to the public. And yeah, often, as I say, more often than not, I mean, I raise an issue about sitting on the cross tube of the bars, of the bikes, which now, obviously, it's a position that's been banned for descending. But it almost split the peloton 50-50 as far as some guys are saying, what are you talking about? It's incredibly safe to ride like that, when you can't hold your brakes and you're not holding your handlebars and you're not touching your saddle. And the other 50% were saying, yeah, it should be banned, etc. And you've always got this opinion across the peloton of what's safe, what isn't, what the rule should be, what it shouldn't be. And unfortunately, that's why union hasn't worked until now, because it's very difficult. Everybody always seems to have their own agenda, and it's difficult to get everybody on the same page more often than not.
Well, I think that is partly how Adam sees his role as the CPA president. But as I say, it was an interesting conversation. We covered lots of ground, and that will be on the Friends of the Podcast feed very soon, certainly before the end of the week and before, well, launch ourselves into Giro d'Italia fever.
Yes, Lionel, we'll be back next week, won't we, with our full Giro preview, after which on May the 6th, we're into our Giro coverage. I'll be on the ground, Brian Nygaard, but Lionel, you'll be appearing in the podcast every day, pretty much as well, I think every day. Dan, we're going to thank you for your time. We'll be hearing from you, no doubt, in the next few weeks at some point as well. Lionel, we are going to, finally, today, we're going to end on a very sad note, very somber note for those of us, you and I, and there'll be listeners as well, and perhaps also Dan, who came into contact with a gentleman called Chris Baldwin, who was the Astana press officer for a couple of years. He was also the press officer for other teams. And well, Lionel, he was very charismatic, funny, and incredibly, intimidatingly intelligent gentleman who, we learned last week, died suddenly at the age of 52. I think I'm right in saying a real shock for both of us, really. We'd had regular contact with Chris even over the last two or three years when he was no longer working in professional cycling. He was living in Amsterdam, but as I said, he was always a very wry and very learned, insightful commentator on all sorts of issues, from what was going on in cycling to geopolitics. And yeah, we're devastated to learn of his passing. And we're going to hear Chris's voice just to play us out today, aren't we, Lionel?
We are, yes. Chris's route into cycling actually has a connection back to Super Sapiens in a way, because his first job as a press officer was with Team Type 1, the team founded by Phil Sutherland, the Super Sapiens founder, of course. And then when they became the Novo Nordisk team and went a fully diabetic roster, Chris wanted to kind of step up in the world of professional cycling. He was looking for another gig. And, well, he ended up as a press officer for the Astana team. Quite an unlikely fit, you would have thought. An American working as the press officer for a Kazakh team. But he had studied Russian in college, incredibly well-traveled, incredibly curious person, had an anecdote. I think I wrote this in the 1101 Cappuccino tribute I did last week, but he had an anecdote for pretty much every occasion, and some of them seemed so outlandish, it was almost as if he was kind of running through a sort of stand-up comedy routine. I mean, I never quite knew whether some of the things he was telling me were true or not, but he was incredibly engaging. And back in the early days of the Cycling Podcast, he was a semi-regular voice on the podcast, wasn't he? Because he was kind of a window into the Astana team, which at the time was quite opaque for us as English-speaking journalists. Of course, 2014 was when Vincenzo Nibali won the Tour de France, and so Chris was very busy, you know, fielding media requests and what have you. But Richard and I spoke to him a number of times, and what you're going to hear now is Chris explaining his kind of circuitous route into the job at the Astana team. This was recorded at the Giro d'Italia Grande Partenza in Ireland in 2014. But we would like to pass on our condolences to Chris's friends and family. He's a big loss to the world of cycling, even though he wasn't working in it in recent years, somebody that we all got to know and like very much on the circuit.
I got a phone call, totally unexpected, from a guy named Vasily Davidenko, who's a Russian-American, who was running a team called Team Type 1 at the time. And he said, hey, Chris, I got a budget for a team. We're going to race in Europe. We're at a pro-continental level. We need a press officer. Are you interested? And I thought back, and I'd known Vasily for about 10 years, because in America, when I had lived there, I'd always gone to these bike races, and I'd done work for Cycling News. I covered the Criterium Champions one year, and I wasn't a terribly good cycling journalist, because I would write way too many words for
I don't believe that.
You can't be wordy. If anything, the one thing a writer's taught me is that you really have to distill it into one sentence per paragraph, and you really have to cut it down like that. But anyway, Vasily called me up and said, I need somebody to do this press officer thing, and I had no idea about PR or internet or anything, but it was a lot like that same move that I made from Kyrgyzstan to Moscow when I just started working at a newspaper. Yeah, I'll do it. And so I did it for 2 years with Vasily at Team Type 1, and that was a really interesting project because they had these six or seven kids with diabetes who were racing, and all these other guys. And in our first year, we didn't have so much success. We won the Tour of Turkey, but in our second year, we did really well at the Tour of Austria, and we did really well with races all around the world, and it was a really good project. But what happened was the sponsor changed for Team Type 1, and they were taken from their old sponsor to a new sponsor, Novo Nordisk. And one of the stipulations in the change was that they were going to go to be an all-diabetic squad. And that changes the dynamic of the kinds of invitations that they're going to get to the races that they're going to go to, at least in the first few years. And I kind of thought, well, wait a minute, I like the team, I like the project, these are good friends of mine, I really want to do this, but why don't I try and seek my way up. And so what happened was, at the Tour of Turkey that year, in the second stage, the two riders went in a breakaway. One of them was Laszlo Bodrogi, our guy, and the other guy was Alexander Vinokurov, who's the leader of this Astana team. And so what happened, the way I got this job was, those two guys went in the break. Bodrogi took the points for the beauty jersey that you get in the Tour of Turkey, and Vinokurov got the most aggressive rider jersey. And you know, in the Tour of Turkey, there's like 7 or 8 podium presentations every day. And so what happened was, I went up and I stood next to Vinokurov. And Vinokurov's a small, diminutive man, but he's nonetheless terrifying. Most people are just absolutely petrified of the guy because, you know, he looks like he could just sort of like a chocolate bunny. Yeah. And I just started talking to him. I said, hey, you know, Bodrogi broke his leg too. Because this was in Alexander Vinokurov was building his leg back up. And he looked at me. First of all, he looked at me like, what strange man is speaking Russian to me? How is this possible? And then he relaxed a little bit. And I said, yeah, you know, he broke his leg. Bodrogi broke his leg, but he didn't get the chance to recover. And so he's had struggled trying to come back in. But, hey, you're looking good, you know. And he's like, oh, yeah. And then he started telling me, they put a spike in my leg this long. I got French guys doing it. It's awesome. I'm going to, you know, I'm training this year. I'm going to get back in and try and race again. And I said, oh, cool. He said, oh, cool. What's your name? And I'm Chris. Oh, see you later, Chris. And then that night, Vasily comes up to me at the restaurant. He's like, oh, I got really good news for you, Chris. What is it, Vasily? Astana wants to hire you.
On the basis of that one conversation?
No, they yeah, more or less. Because they're like, oh, God, here's a guy who speaks Russian. Oh, my God, he speaks Russian. He can do this job. And what happened, it turns out, Vasily Davydenko is a really good friend of Alexander Schaefer, who is the director sportif of this team. And because they're such good friends, Vasily was able to vouch for me in more or less a second and say, oh, yeah, Chris is a good guy. He knows what he's doing. Also, he wants to leave us because he kind of wants a promotion. And that's how it worked out.
Now you're here.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.